What is the relationship between the U.S. and China going forward? What is a trade relationship? What is a political relationship? What is a military relationship? What is a business relationship? Those are all going to change because we're not dealing with a poor country here that's on the rise that has all these advantages and all these forgiveness for various things. We're dealing with a superpower versus a superpower, and they've got to come to realignment with each other.
This is Inside Asia, and my guest this episode, you've just heard his voice, and if you're an Asia insider, you recognize it, is the inimitable Jim McGregor, author of No Ancient Wisdom, No Followers, The Challenges of Chinese Authoritarian Capitalism, and others. Jim is a longtime China watcher and a friend of the show. That's too long of an introduction for a man who needs no introduction, so let's get to it. In the wake of deteriorating U.S.-China relations, I gave Jim a call. From his post in Shanghai, what's his take on the current standoff? Is this a matter of diplomatic brinkmanship, waiting to see who blinks first, or is there more to it?
This is a new paradigm. I don't think this is a trade skirmish, and then they come to some kind of an agreement and walk away. I think it's a fundamental realignment of the U.S.-China relationship. The Deng Xiaoping era is over. Let's think about this. If you look at the last 30 years or more, it's been that China was a poor country emerging from a complete mess that was of its own making, actually. But there was a lot of goodwill from the West and brought in bar associations, trade associations, and universities brought in a lot of know-how and structuring laws. We opened our markets, we opened our universities, and then China, did a hell of a lot of innovation here to build infrastructure and supply chains and make it very convenient and affordable for manufacturing in this country for export back to, U.S., Europe, Japan, wherever. And there was a lot of friction, but things kind of went along. And now that era is over. We're into a new era, and I don't think anybody really knows our way out of this. But I think a lot of the business people I talk to know that things change, but I don't think they're recognizing that this is a fundamental remake of the relationship. And we really don't know what that's going to look like, but we know the forces that are leading to it happening.
Jim, is it the nature of the two economies and their state of development, or is it a matter of the two leaders of those countries and their methods for trying to get something out of the other?
Well, I think it's part of it is the political DNA of the two systems is somewhat incompatible, and we've been able to paper that over. But the flexibility in each political system has disappeared, and I think that gets to your question about the leaders. Mm. I mean, Xi Jinping is this indigenous innovation and strategic emerging industries and Made in China 2025, all of these tech policies that are a zero-sum game and frightened the technology companies of the West. So They started out under who and when, but Xi comes in and he just grabs control and really wrenches the system back to top down Leninism and a cult of personality, and it's all about fear and discipline in the system, and it's about really ratcheting up the victimization, and that the West is out to keep us down and keep us poor, and we've got to unite against that. Meanwhile, on the outside, you've got whether Hillary or Trump got was going to be a pushback on China, probably in very different styles and probably some different substance. But Trump comes in and he's, the Chinese kind of underestimated him. They looked at him as a businessman who didn't really have any strong beliefs and that they could kind of be friendly and buy a bunch of stuff. And, he would settle down. They don't realize that there's one thing that Trump has expressed belief in for decades. It's trade and the U.S. Getting bamboozled on trade globally. So if there's anything this guy believes in, it's that. And it's amazing to see how China doesn't know how to react. They're still trying to talk to their old friend, the investment bankers and the venture people and the tycoons, and thinking, and the big multinational bosses, and thinking that talking to them will smooth this over and they'll get Trump to behave himself. And they don't recognize that we're into a remake. I mean, you've got to look at where this administration is going. This is, we're now moving towards, Mike Pence's, speech of October 4th, I guess, was very much a kind of a new Cold War kind of speech, and then kind of signaling an all of government pushback on China, not just with trade, but with firming up a military response and all kinds of other things. So, again, as I started out to say, we're in uncharted territory.
Well, it does feel like posturing, Jim. I mean, just like you say it, I mean, the timeliness of Pence's conversation and this Cold War rhetoric, it seems like it's all scripted to some degree. I mean, and at the end of the day, we are talking about negotiation, whether to get these trade deals done or renegotiate some of the terms. And you've got two very strong, hard-headed individuals at the top of these countries who pride themselves as being able to get things done, whether they can or can't. So again, it's how much of this is posturing and how much of this is real stuff, which is going to start to bite at that commercial level.
I guess it's a combination of both, if you want to look at it that way. But remember, a lot of other stuff going on at the same time. I mean, in July, there was a presidential executive order to really re-examine the U.S. Defense industrial base and supply chain and reorient that back to the United States. Hmm. What they're pushing China on is, well, they, Mnuchin in July, I think, well, no, I'm sorry, in May, Mnuchin brought, 142 demands to China that the U.S. is sitting back waiting for them to do something. And I really am not sure that this is going to be resolved in any short fashion. And remember, let's remember where Congress is on this. China, I'm in Washington twice a year with a lot of meetings, and I can tell you, China's got no friends in Washington outside the Chinese embassy right now. I mean, look at the vote on the CFIUS, the investment, it's called FIRMA, right, to foreign investment in the United States and be able to block and control a much wider range of investments than they had. And this is, completely aimed at China. I mean, the vote on that was, let me try to remember, I think it was 85-10 in the Senate and 400-2 in the House. I mean, Congress is very fired up about this. China had to work pretty hard to turn all these people against China, but they've done a good job of it.
Yeah, but politically, Jim, you're not going to, lose any votes over voting against China. I mean, and you will lose votes if you vote with them. So, I mean, I can kind of see how it would be swayed in that direction. And obviously there have been some abuses on the Chinese side as well. Everyone acknowledges that. But it still comes down to this question, ultimately, who's going to blink first on this? Because, it's really disturbing when I hear you say that you don't see any kind of near-term resolution to this. Trump, perhaps, I don't know, what do you think? Do you think he's being empowered by some of his bullying tactics? I mean, look at Canada and NAFTA, or, Japan's prime minister just, kowtowed to, his determination to have bilateral talks. Do you think that he's thinking, hey, it's starting to work, I'm getting the results I want, or at least the bilateral discussions? Is he expecting the same from China anytime soon?
Well, I think they actually might be stumbling into a strategy. Hmm. He was going after everybody, everybody when he came into office, and he also went after steel and aluminum. But what he's done by that, NAFTA, he's claiming victory on NAFTA, whatever they're calling it now, USMCA. Or something, they basically made some small fixes, not all that important. Actually, a number of the fixes were actually EP language from the Trans-Pacific Partnership that he canceled into office. But the world has seen that this guy is serious, about not scared to really push the envelope on these things. So you talk to people in Washington, and they think this is going to go on for quite a while. Now the Chinese and I think others have the view that when this starts biting in the American economy, that that Trump will back down. It's farmers and manufacturers who are going to be hit by this. And let's remember that, the exporting companies out of China that will be hit by the U.S. Import tariffs, 50% of exports from China from foreign invested enterprise, and it's like 70 to 80% when it comes to technology. So that will come back on American companies. That's the one unknown we have. But again, this has been brewing for a long time. The business community has become disenchanted with China, and they used to be China's best friend in Washington. China worked hard at pushing so hard that they overreached, and they lost the support of the business community. And the CEOs, when they're in China now, they're smiling and friendly, but when they're in their boardrooms, they're looking at the threat from China and how do we deal with it. Now, what we're seeing here in supply chains right now is that American companies that manufacture in China and for the China market are bringing those supply chains in to serve that manufacturing capacity. When you manufacture outside of China and you get components from China, they're moving those supply chains out. So there is a realignment happening on supply chains and borders. These tariffs are having that effect step by step. Everybody is de-risking the best they can.
Yeah, but Jim, just as U.S. companies might be contemplating a return to the U.S., I mean, Chinese companies are diversifying by sending manufacturing capabilities outside of China to Southeast Asia in order to sidestep some of these tariffs. Do you see that happening? Is that picking up? Is that a real strategy, or is that an interim move in your view?
Well, there's a lot of forces here that would push on a lot of this lower end manufacturing or even medium manufacturing leaving China for many years. The cost of labor here is so expensive. There's a labor shortage. All the government fees you have to pay for various social programs. China was pricing itself out of the market, but right. The supply chains were so good and the logistics were so good, it kept them here longer than those normal economics would.
I mean, right.
Wages are now, it's cheaper in Mexico than here. So this, I think, is breaking away that hold that the supply chains held on to. This is a shift that's happening over some time. I'm not talking about a cataclysmic thing here. But it is a paradigm shift in where we're going to be sitting in 5 years from now.
I want to return to what you said about stumbling into a strategy. I think that's quite interesting because I it's almost like Trump has been saying all along he wants American companies to return onshore. He's looking for ways to incentivize or de-incentivize companies to do that. By virtue of pushing this approach and calling for an all-out trade war and raising those tariffs, is he going to ultimately force U.S. companies to return to the U.S.? And at that point, the thing that he's hoping for is then job creation. Well, you and I both know that, the age of robotics is upon us and manufacturing upgrades will probably be with technology, not with people. So how do you feel about that? Do you think that might play out?
I'm not sure that their rhetoric is about jobs in the U.S., but the truth of the matter is we don't have a labor force in the U.S. that can even do it. And
right.
I don't even know if we have the managers for the robotics factories. Actually, I was at a very, very large Chinese electronics manufacturer about 2 weeks ago with the chairman. This is a multi-billion dollar company. I was in a plant that had 50 billion RMB investment. And I asked the chairman, I said, well, you know, what about these tariffs? What does that mean for you? What will you move some of your manufacturing to the U.S.? He said the U.S. does not have the labor force, and they don't even have the engineers, and they don't have the managers of those of these robotics factories. I'll just expand in Mexico. And, you know, I'm not so sure that Trump is unhappy with that. I think they might be more driven to move this stuff out of China than to move it all back to the States.
This is Inside Asia. You're listening to my conversation with Jim McGregor, author of No Ancient Wisdom, No Followers, and 1 Billion Customers, Lessons from the Front Lines of Doing Business in China. He's a regular commentator on China business trends and advisor to some of the world's leading multinationals. More in a moment. I'm Steve Stein, and I'm speaking with Jim McGregor, a formidable China expert, author, and advisor to global corporations. In the second part of our conversation, I follow up on a point he made before the break, that the Trump administration's aggression towards China is more far-reaching than first anticipated. Trump's rant about Chinese stealing U.S. jobs and unfair trade practices are mere smokescreens. The real agenda, perhaps, is the destabilization of China in the wake of its growth, empowerment, and increasingly central position in the world.
Well, that's the Chinese point of view, that, you know, that this is all about trying to keep China down because they're rising and can rival the U.S. And so it's all about keeping China down. And they're a victim of our own, desire to stay on top and not let them rise. The U.S. point of view is that China has overreached. You know, they've been treated pretty well. We had open markets and China has violated the spirit and substance of WTO. There's, you know, the what they're doing on technology with forced technology transfers, or, you know, the whole just innovation and mastering the foreign technology, and now Made in China 2025, that is about dominating all, you know, a lot of the manufacturing technologies of the future by using every tool they have, the advantages the state has with capital and the companies that do not have to make a profit. Because what you're looking at here is, if China buys a foreign technology company, that company is now a Chinese company here, and it has all the market openings, all of the financing, all of the facilities and everything it needs. And it can kill the other foreign companies in that business in China, which then eliminates them globally because this market is so important. So it's really the difference between the two systems. Both sides have a whole different view of how they're looking at why this is happening. And never the twain shall meet. And I do not, they're talking past each other at this point. I mean, one thing that is, Trump and Xi are going to meet in the end of November in Argentina at the G20. From what I've been hearing from my friends in government, that the White House is the one that asked for that meeting. They're the ones that made the request to the Chinese for that meeting. So that's kind of interesting that the White House would be looking for that at this point. But again, when it comes to this administration, who's in charge? Mnuchin wants to do a deal and walk away and wipe his hands of this and keep the markets going. Ross wants the president to love him again and be a player. Lighthizer has a very focused and strong, industrial pushing back on China's in industrial policy. Who's in charge? Who's in charge on any given day? Well, you don't know.
Well, that's, it's interesting just back, on some of the commercial accomplishments. And, some people are now saying we need to start to look at companies differently. Instead of what they produce, they're looking back over their operating costs, their profitability, their earnings capabilities. We should look forward and start to analyze companies with a different eye, which would be towards their ability to quickly adapt, to create more kind of a nimble, very flexible kind of operating and organizational styles. And it's based on those capabilities and obviously applications of future technologies, AI, machine learning, and other, that's going to ultimately determine which organizations, which companies are strongest in the world. And if you look at it that way, all of a sudden, some of these Chinese companies are starting to look pretty interesting and therefore rather imposing from the perspective of U.S. corporations or the U.S. government. What do you think about that? Do you think that that's dry? Again, I'm really curious to understand whether or not this is an attempt to try to hold on to what we've got in the U.S. And stave off any possibility that, this rise of the Chinese organizations and corporations are going to push the U.S. off the scene.
Well, the unfortunate thing here is that China is very capable of building a strong technology sector. They have the talent. They've got the entrepreneurs. They've got the engineers. How many people have gone to Carnegie Mellon and MIT and wherever, and they've worked for Google, Microsoft, HP. There's a talent pool, and there's also endless venture capital money, and the Chinese are very active in venture capital, both in government venture capital, but also in private venture capital. If they had just let these entrepreneurs go around and buy companies using venture capital from all over the world to do so, there would be no problem, and actually they could have gotten moved ahead. Instead, being the Communist Party, they have to come up with something that is dominating and imposing from the center, and it's about enormous amounts of money. It's about China beating everybody and decimating everybody else, and the world has paid attention to that. So I think you have to allow that China's made a lot of its own problems. Now, at the same time, China is planning 5, 10, 20, 30, 40 years ahead. It's got a vision, it's executing on it, it's got a plan, and that's something to be admired. Meanwhile, the U.S., we're trying to put in yet another tax cut so we starve our government so we can't put money into science and engineering. We're talking about, limiting foreign students in engineering and sciences. I'm afraid the U.S. is becoming India. We're going to have a lot of rich people and a poor government. So, you're right in that we need to get our stuff together in the United States, very much so. But I don't buy into the China as a victim narrative. China's caused this problem themselves.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I guess yes to some degree, but can you blame a country from just wanting to get ahead and build these capabilities? They've had what people refer to as an adaptive authoritarian approach, really quite nimble. And a lot of people have this view that it's central government, centrally planned 5-10 year plans. But no, at least for up until the time of Xi, Deng and forward, there was a lot of flexibility. A lot of municipalities were able to do things differently. A lot of provinces could kind of deploy different ideas and experiment. It sounds like some of that is being cracked down on in the name of anti-corruption. But I think what you're saying here, and help me understand if this is right, they've overcorrected to the point where we now have such strong central authority that it will snuff out whatever entrepreneurship exists in China today. Overstatement, but what do you think of that?
No, you're actually you brought up a different subject that is important. With the advent of this cult of personality and top-down Leninism, you're right. I mean, all those things you say that went on during the reform era that made this place so successful, that stuff is being pushed back on. And, the bureaucracy, the bureaucrats are all doing political inspections and hiding under their desks these days instead of making decisions. That is all true. But what I think what the West doesn't see is at the same time, they are empowering entrepreneurs. The venture capital money that's available for Chinese entrepreneurs, the low-cost facilities, the assistance, the help, They also are smart enough, and this is Lika Chang, the premier, really pushing this on technology entrepreneurship by private sector people. So it is a mixed bag. Agreed. We don't know where that's going to end up. That, you know, where she is taking this country. What is that going to do on its own to the economy? How vulnerable are they to the disruptions from caused by these U.S. tariffs and the trade skirmish and trade battles? You know, how much is that going to unsettle this economy? There's reports that, you know, it's slowing down a bit, and there's worries about that. And what does that mean about, you know, continuing to, because you know, they've got to grow out of all their debt problems. We don't know where that's going to end up. So I guess we do get down to here now, who's going to blink first? You know, when the farmers really feel the bite of these tariffs, when the manufacturers in the U.S. really feel the bite of these tariffs, when job losses here and this economy has a downturn, it hits the real estate market, you know, will these guys, you know, I guess I'm talking myself into a little bit of what you were saying, is there will come a point where hopefully there'll come a point where these guys will both have to say, okay, let's come to some kind of a conclusion here. And that will probably happen somewhere down the road in the next year or two. But what I'm also saying is, going forward, we're living in a different world.
Yeah.
You know, the relationship between these two countries that was based on a bit of trust and some friendliness, that's out the window now. It's going to be a different paradigm, and I'm not sure how that looks.
Well, how bad could this be? And whether or not it's, you know, trade only and just these disputes and tariffs, or if it's a broader, you know, underpinning agenda on both fronts to keep the other down, you know, how ugly could this get, Jim? And will they draw the rest of the world into their issues, or can we contain it between, U.S., China, and in terms of them needing to work out their problems?
Well, there are an enormous amount of forces that tie these two countries together, whether it's the 350,000 Chinese students in the U.S. or the, you know, all of the mixed venture capital, all the connections between the Silicon Valley and Shenzhen and Zhongguancun, all of the corporations, all of the people that are married to each other, all of the families. I mean, you can hardly get in a taxi cab and start talking to somebody, and the guy will say, "Oh yeah, I've got a cousin in Ohio," or "I went to Los Angeles once." And so, yeah, all of those ties are there and legitimate. So there's a lot of forces to hold this together, but there's also some very strong forces, ideological and geopolitical and strategic, that could bring, you know, that could bring it apart. It's fragile. It's fragile. I mean, the real sad part of this is Chinese people and Americans get along. Our kids get along. Our students get along. Businesses get along. It's really the DNA of the political systems on both sides, and the politicians on both sides now being, you know, they're both victimized by the other country and really exacerbating that. There are serious problems. There's very serious problems. And I think America has made a lot of its own problems in our own worries about competing in the way we've run our own economy and industrial, lack of industrial policy. But China's made the whole world unhappy with China. In the last decade, with its technology policies, with its business policies, with its Belt and Road Initiative, with its militarizing of the South China Sea, with its bullying tactics on the way it deals with countries, China's done pretty well in alienating a lot of its friends. So there's a lot of blame to go around on many sides. I think that's true. But again, I want to emphasize, we are in a serious realignment, and we don't know what that's going to look like yet.
This is Inside Asia, and you've been listening to my conversation with Jim McGregor, author, China watcher, and corporate advisor. Thanks for listening, and thank you, Jim, for taking time to talk to me. At the end of every episode, I take a moment to sum things up with the Asia Insider Minute. I have two key takeaways this time around. First, Jim's suggestion that the Trump administration may be stumbling into a strategy feels ominous. Is there a chance that this U.S. president's bully tactics might pay dividends? Has the world come to see Trump for what he is, an uncompromising, unyielding force that cares less about what's fair and more about what he wants, even if it means sacrificing a tradition of process and decorum? Has Trump taken Teddy Roosevelt's diplomatic creed to speak softly and carry a big stick to a new level? Will the Trump doctrine be remembered as rant loudly and swing to kill? It's a matter of politics, and even in a communist country like China, leaders are held accountable by the people they serve. Should China's economy begin to falter, as some observers say it has, will Xi Jinping fold, kowtow to the bully in the West, and restore order if only to preserve power? That's the question. Maybe the story is about more than a standoff between two authoritarian figures. Might, dare I suggest, humanism prevail? By virtue of the tight integration between China and the U.S., might calmer voices rise to the defense of a peaceful resolution? How about those 350,000 Chinese students studying in American universities, the tens of thousands of Chinese graduates working in Silicon Valley, or the legions of Chinese executives working in U.S. cities? All have a vested interest in a peaceful outcome. Most everyone, no matter where you are in America, has a friend or a neighbor who is either Chinese or of Chinese descent. Similarly, in China's big cities, it's actually hard to run into someone who doesn't have a cousin or an uncle who, for one reason or the other, studied, worked, or immigrated to the U.S. That made me think about our last Cold War. Back when it was a U.S.-Russia standoff, no one had a Soviet neighbor, classmate, or work colleague. Our political and economic systems were diametrically opposed. Soviets were cast as the great enemy, and in the absence of high-speed data networks that link one nation to the next, all we could do was believe it. China is different. The country embraced capitalism and showed what ingenuity, grit, and government support could do to catapult a nation from poverty to wealth. The things that divide the U.S. from China are far less severe than the things that divide the U.S. from the Soviet Union. Our fear this time, so it appears, has less to do with ideology and more to do with who gets the economic upper hand. There's no question that social media is a powerful propaganda tool that can divide us, and we should probably brace ourselves for more of that in the near future, an escalation, that is, of content vilifying China. But maybe the answer here is right outside our front door. McGregor's take on the current escalation of tensions between the U.S. and China is that it's mostly institutional, that the issues separating the countries exist at the government and corporate level, but not at the human level. As Jim points out, Chinese and American people really get along well, and maybe there's some hope in that. Maybe it'll be the human condition that allows us to rise above the pragmatism and cynicism of policymakers and do the right thing, the human thing. Until next episode, this is Steve Stein saying, coming from the outside on Inside Asia. As always, we thank you for listening.